Good evening and welcome to tonight's Park City Area Project for Deeper Understanding Forum. I'm Renee Bodley Miller, President and General Manager of KPCW Radio. We're the community nonprofit radio station serving Summit and Wasatch counties over the air and citizens worldwide over the internet. KPCW is broadcasting this forum live. In addition to the people here tonight at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Park City, I'd like to welcome everyone who's listening at home, in their cars, or on their computers, or on their smartphones. The topic for tonight's forum is the Me Too movement. The hashtag Me Too spread like wildfire last October, demonstrating the widespread prevalence of sexual assault and harassment, especially in the workplace. Suddenly, survivors had a voice, emboldened by a tidal wave of support and the sheer volume of social media posts where people shared their stories, women and men. Movie moguls, media icons, politicians, they were suddenly exposed as predators. It seemed not a day went by without a new headline about a new accusation against a new perpetrator. The headlines have died down, but has the awareness died with it? Is Me Too a movement or just a moment? Is Me Too permanently changing how we view the opposite sex? If so, how? Are we smarter? Or did we overreact? Before we get to the panel, a reminder about the Project for Deeper Understanding. This is a safe place where honest questions get frank answers, and above all, respect for differing opinions is paramount. So let's get started. We have a distinguished panel of guests this evening, ranging from researchers to attorneys to newspaper columnists and past public officials. I'd like the panel to each take 30 seconds to introduce themselves to the audience. Robin Scribner, we'll start with you.
I'm Robin Scribner. I'm a researcher at the Utah Women in Leadership Project at Utah Valley University. We spent the last year and a half writing a series of research snapshots on various issues of great interest to Utah women, and our most recent snapshot was on sexual harassment.
I'm Michael Bryan. I'm an employment lawyer at the Jones Waldo Law Firm, and I spend most of my days talking to clients about issues like sexual harassment, how to deal with problems like that in the workplace, how to prevent them if possible, and from time to time we end up in court dealing with them as well.
My name is Marina Gomberg, and as Renee said, I am a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. I joke that I'm a communications professional by day and an activist and writer by night. I work at the University of Utah, and I also sit on the board of Equality Utah, and I live in Salt Lake City with my wife and my son Harvey, named after one of my favorite humans, Harvey Milk.
Good evening. My name is Eric Strindberg. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Strindberg and Skolnick. We represent employees in these type of cases, sexual harassment cases, other Title VII cases, both here in Utah and in Idaho. I've been doing this now for some 35 years.
Good evening. My name is Kendra Wyckoff, and I'm the executive director for Peace House. Peace House is the domestic violence victim service provider, and we also provide supportive services to sexual assault survivors. I've worked in the field for about 18 years, working with domestic violence and sexual assault survivors in different capacities, and I'm happy to be here tonight. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jake Job. I'm a teacher at Park City High School. I teach a course in social justice. I'm also a doctoral student at the University of Utah in education with an emphasis in social justice. My students study this and other topics like this every day.
Liza Simpson, longtime resident and originally from Berkeley, California. So social activism has been part of my life since I was 6 years old, standing in front of the Oakland City Hall holding a sign that I won't describe to you now. Two-term city council member and longtime resident. I'm just thrilled to be part of this panel. Thank you.
Wow, thanks, everybody. I want to start with you, Marina. You wrote a column in the Salt Lake Tribune about the Me Too movement. The title was, Me Too Wasn't Perfect, But It Rocked My World. How so?
Well, I think the idea originally spurred because I was interested in the backlash about Me Too. People were immediately critical, as we are wont to be. But what was so powerful to me is this sort of connection to the idea of women coming out. as a person who, as a queer person who had to come out, there are these really interesting similarities for me. And so to watch these people decide to publicly say who they are and what their experience was really was a powerful thing, and especially as somebody who had had a similar experience before the actual movement came out. And so I was really hoping that people would tend to focus on what was really powerful about it rather than taking the time to critique or try to fine-tune the movement as it was initially.
So what does the Me Too movement mean to you?
The Me Too movement means it's a coming out. It's a coming out, which to me is a couple of things. The first of which is, it's an experience to say, this is who I am, and I love myself enough to be honest about who I am and to pick up for how much you may not love me, despite my experience, despite my preferences. And then the second thing is to become part of a like group and to shed the weight of silence and loneliness.
I told you guys I was going to ask you each what the Me Too movement means to you, so I'm going to skip to that. Mike O'Brien, what does it mean to you?
Well, and Eric probably has a similar experience, but I feel like we've been dealing with the Me Too movement in my profession, you know, defending employers for many, many years. So it's not a new problem, obviously. It received a lot of attention appropriately so recently. But I've been with my firm for 30 years, and you know, we've been having to deal with sexual harassment issues on a regular basis. So it's been an ongoing problem. So it's a very familiar circumstance to me. It's one that I deal with professionally and help employers try to minimize at the workplace, avoid if possible. So it's something that's very familiar. But it was also, I think, very interesting and I think empowering to see the moment get national attention. I don't think it got this much national attention comparably, except, you know, back during the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill hearings and the, you know, the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky situation. So every once in a while, there's these teaching moments, I call them, that arise. And so it was certainly grateful on my part to see a national look at an issue that, you know, we've been trying to eradicate and deal with for many years.
Robin, what does Me Too mean to you?
Well, it's a really important step in what needs to be a process of everybody coming on board with the idea that everybody, man and woman, deserves to be treated fairly and with respect and dignity. And the fact that this was such a wildfire, not just here nationally, but globally, millions and millions of women and men use this opportunity to say, I've experienced this as well. And the fact that it was so widespread and so many people were surprised by it, right? Like a lot of men came out and said, I can't believe all my friends, like I'm looking around and every woman I know is saying me too. And so the fact that there's these types of issues really thrive in silence. And so the Me Too movement is so powerful because it's bringing something to light that we all know has been going on. But when it becomes personal, it becomes so much more powerful.
So, Eric, does it surprise you to hear Robin say it's coming to light, or do you agree with Mike it's something you've been dealing with for a long time?
Well, I think, like Mike, it is something that we've been doing. I've been doing for 35 years. I think the first sexual harassment case I had was against a mining company in Wyoming. So, yes, it's something that's been going on and on for many years. What I see the big change right now from employment standpoint or my professional standpoint is that we used to have women calling up who've been subjected to harassment who would ask, can you help me? Now they're asking, will you help me? And that's, I think, a significant change. But I also want to add, there's something very personal too. I have a 21-year-old daughter, and it's very pleasing to me to hope that the type of world that she will go into, employment world, will not include the type of behavior that women have experienced. I remember when I started doing this work, my mother, who was a professional and started working in around 1950, she was sort of would scoff at some of the things I would tell her about the types of cases, and her response was, well, if you're a woman in the workplace, you have to expect those type of things. And women shouldn't have to expect those type of things, and I hope my daughter doesn't have to experience them.
Kendra, you're on the front lines of Me Too at the Peace House, aren't you?
Yeah, we are. And I have to say, you know, we hear from survivors every day. how empowering it is, how hopeful it can be to know that there's a shared experience when it comes to victimization and sexual abuse and harassment. And it can also be triggering for survivors as well. And so we have to spend a considerable amount of time having conversations and creating supportive and safe spaces for people who've been impacted by violence victimization, because they're hearing the stories that other people are that other people have experienced. And although it creates this shared space and this shared understanding that I'm not alone and I'm a survivor, and there are other people that have had similar experiences, they can be triggered by that. And so it's important as a provider that supports survivors that we're there to help them along that journey as well.
Oh, I have a lot of follow-up questions for you on that. Jacob, Me Too movement, what does it mean to you? You're a high school teacher.
Yeah, so I think... like everyone here has mentioned, I think it's something that all of us knew was going on for a long time. I know the Me Too as a title is 10 years old. Wrote down her name. Tarana Burke, 10 years ago started talking about Me Too. As a teacher, I teach juniors and seniors predominantly, and we're sending students off to college. And this conversation is so important, I think, for them. I think personally, Me Too to me is kind of like giving testimony. And those combined testimonies tell a story that for a long time we have been wanting to hear and have been wanting to tell. And I think the taboo nature of those stories has made it so that it can kind of lurk behind the scenes. And Me Too really kind of... brings forth the problems that we've had and kind of demands attention. And so I think for me as a teacher, that's what I think about is the stories being told and then how my students can learn from that as they move forward and hopefully prompt a cultural shift that I think we need really badly.
It's going to be interesting to hear your stories about what your students are saying to you about this. So, Liza, you've been in City Hall 2 terms as a city council person. What does Me Too mean to you?
You know, as a couple of the other panelists have said, one of the things that I find most effective and moving about the Me Too movement is, I have an elderly relative who sent an email out to the entire family about having been assaulted 40 years ago. And she never told anyone until she sent that email to the family. And the fact that she felt like she was able to come forward because she wasn't alone, to me, is an incredibly moving piece. I mean, God knows we need the cultural change, and God knows those are all important parts of this movement, and we will see the cultural change. So anybody out there who's worried about it, you know, we're coming for you. But the reality is for me, the Me Too movement, that it gave, the fact that it gave a victim a safe place to step forward and come out, as you said, and not feel alone is incredible.
That was great. Thank you, everybody. We're going to just launch into some questions and hopefully have a hearty dialogue surrounding those questions. Mike O'Brien, you've worked in human resource law for decades. You said you're seeing a surge of questions from business owners as the result of the Me Too movement. You've been dealing with this for a long time, you said, but you are seeing an increase in these calls in the last year. What are these businesses' concerns, and what are you telling them?
We get a variety of questions about it. One is people want training about it. So I've probably done 100 training programs in the last 6 months or so for businesses, supervisors on how to deal with these issues, how to create a culture where these sorts of problems don't arise. So we get a lot of questions and requests for training. A lot of people say, hey, we have a policy on this. Take a look at it. Is it adequate? Is it adequate? Are we meeting the legal standards? Are we doing what we need to make sure our employees are protected? And of course, we have people who, because there's a higher sensitivity to this issue with the issue in the news, we have employees raising issues. And so we've received a lot of questions from clients about, you know, problem, this problem has arose or this problem has arisen. And what do we do about it? How do we protect the company? How do we protect the employee? How do we obviously minimize the risk of liability? How do we educate our workforce about it? So we've seen questions and calls in all three of those areas.
So you hear from employers and they say, do I tell my employees they can't date each other anymore?
Yeah, well, I got a call about, you know, can we hug people anymore? Can I compliment somebody anymore? You know, can I go to lunch with a female coworker? I mean, we get all sorts of questions along those lines.
Well, if the Vice President of the United States is saying, I can't go have dinner alone with a woman, is that on the advice of his attorney? And is that sexual harassment? Is he
saying... He's not getting that advice from me. I mean, I have a number of very smart female coworkers who make me look great every day and give great service to our clients, and I regularly meet with them, you know, in my office alone or go to lunch with them. So I think he really set a bad example for the country by making that statement, and if he got that advice from a lawyer, he needs to get a new lawyer, in my opinion.
Anyone want to chime in on that?
Well, I agree with what Mike is saying about our dear vice president. I mean, part of the problem is if you, as a man in the workplace, say, I'm never going to go to work with a woman, you miss business opportunities, you miss development opportunities. So you may protect yourself from claims of sexual harassment, but you're doing as much damage. You're really discriminating against that person who you refuse to see as an equal. So I think his comments about that are very, very disturbing to me. It's sort of this attitude of, you know, if I'm with an attractive woman at lunch alone, I'm going to do something bad. Well, let's face it, guys, you got to get over that. And yes, you know, you're going to work with attractive women. Get over it and treat them as coworkers, not as, you know, something else.
Robin, you wanted to add to that?
Well, that's one of the concerns. We work specifically with women in leadership, and when we're looking at all the efforts that we're making to advance women in leadership in politics and in business and in all our different settings, the Me Too movement is critically important, but at the same time, everyone needs to not overreact, right? And specifically men. We know that there are some men who are worried, right? They feel scared. They're like, I can't do anything. But the danger of this setting back all the progress that we're making, advancing women in all these areas, is also something that we really need to think about. And that's why these conversations that you're having with employers about what is okay, what is appropriate, you know, be professional and not say, we're not going to hire any more women because what if we have all these problems of sexual harassment? I mean, that's something that would be super unfortunate. And we need to work to make sure that we're having open, honest, thoughtful conversations about this to avoid that type of backlash against this.
That ties into something that Liza had said. A friend of yours, a leader in our community, told you he was afraid to hug people now.
Well, and it's interesting because he and I were having this conversation. And he wasn't so much afraid to hug people as much as he was saying, what do I do? How do I know? And it's really simple. Just ask. You know, I mean, and this applies to men, women, children. It doesn't matter. Don't touch people unless you know they want to be touched. I mean, we have a longtime member of the community whose habit I noticed years ago when approaching women in the hallway would put his hand, excuse me, Jeb, can I touch you?
Yeah.
would put his hand on their shoulders like this in a very, I'm sorry, I felt patronizing way. And I never noticed him do it with men. I only noticed him do it with women. And, you know, I pretty much stay out of reach now. But you just ask.
So, Jacob, what are you hearing from your students? Are they asking, can I hug you? Do they talk to each other? Are they more open with each other than maybe an older generation?
I would say the conversation is there. Where I notice it, so next week we have Know Before You Go at the high school, which is it's put on by Planned Parenthood and the Teen Council about consent. And what's really interesting, so they have to have parental permission to attend that. And they'll go, and what's really interesting is afterwards, a lot of the questions, both from boys and girls, but especially from the boys, about, I didn't know that wasn't okay. And hearing it, a lot of the stories, to me, it seems obvious that it's not, but again, the culture, they're focusing more on like a college experience, right? So when you're heading from high school to college, what are your rights? How should you behave? How does consent work and all those things? And students hear stories and they see things in the media and on TV and all this stuff, and they assume that that's how it works. So then when someone tells them that's not how it works, they start kind of asking these questions. And so as teachers then, we have to be ready to answer those questions. And I think a lot of teachers aren't prepared to do that. And so what it creates is a tough situation where you want to give students good advice, and some teachers aren't comfortable in that space because it's a more complicated topic maybe than like math or science, right? And kind of going back to some of the other points, I think that we need to teach kids that, yeah, you have to ask, and things that were perceived as just okay because they went on are not. And I think people kind of are pushing back against, like, well, but it used to be okay, but just because it used to be doesn't make it okay now. And so, or that it was even okay then, it's just that people didn't report it or didn't feel they could. And so students are asking these questions, and like I said, we're sending them off to college, and some of them have really good answers and are studying it and want to know more, and some of them are kind of in limbo of not quite, you know, they don't quite know what they can and can't do. In terms of what you see at school, obviously teenagers are not necessarily hesitant to touch each other in the hallway, which sometimes we have to mention to them, like, hey, not what you want to be doing at school. But I think that, like I said, I think it starts with the education, and I think we start it way too late. Mm-hmm. I think by waiting till they're seniors, that's way too late. For sure.
Kendra, you work on outreach. The Peace House does an education on this topic.
Yes, we have a prevention education program where last year we were able to get in front of almost 10,000 students in both Summit and Wasatch County and provide age-appropriate curriculum. And so we start, you know, in the elementary school age talking about child abuse prevention and talking about boundaries and, you know, helping kids understand who they can reach out to if they're feeling uncomfortable or they're feeling unsafe, who are supports. And then those conversations graduate as kids get older and we begin to have more conversations about some of the topics that are happening here on the front line next week in the school around, you know, healthy relationships and teen dating violence and consent, and really helping young people understand how to have boundaries, what appropriate behavior is, how to respond if they're seeing inappropriate behavior. So as a bystander, what can they do to offer support to their friends or their peers and intervene in that situation in a safe way? And then how they can ask for support and what resources are available.
Robin, who is the victim in Utah? This piece of paper that we handed out to the crowd that they can also see, I believe, on your website.
Yes.
It's the snapshot about sexual assault victims and some staggering numbers in that report.
I didn't understand your question. Who is the victim in Utah?
Who's the victim in Utah? And what are the numbers? What are the numbers of sexual assault victims in Utah that you've outlined in your report?
Well, our numbers for sexual assault are higher than they are in the nation. And that surprises a lot of people. We think we've got these family-focused communities and things like that, but our issues are even more serious. And most striking is that in all other violent crimes in the state, our numbers are well below the national average. But when it comes specifically to sexual assault, our numbers are above the national average, and it's been that way for decades. So that's deeply troubling. When it comes to sexual assault, sexual harassment specifically, those numbers, and again, sexual assault numbers are very hard to pin down as well, because it's
deeply, deeply underreported, just as domestic violence is, and other crimes that are of a very personal nature, and crimes that often come with a deep amount of shame for the survivors, which is another reason why it's so important for us to be talking about this openly. But as far as the harassment numbers, we don't have good numbers as far as the state. We have numbers for how many reports are filed, charges are filed with the EEOC, and we know that those are just a tiny, tiny fraction of the total instances that are occurring within our workplaces and other places.
You had talked about the vulnerable population.
Oh, yes.
The woman who is the victim of sexual assault or harassment in the workplace.
Yeah, so anyone is a potential to experience this, but there are certain vulnerable populations. Women of color, just as they are with many rough circumstances within the United States, are more likely to be working in places where harassment is likely to occur, where there are a lot of women, where it's very low paid occupations, and where women feel like they don't have any power, and they actually don't have any power in those circumstances. But women who are undocumented, they feel terrified to go to a lawyer, right? They can't go, and they're not even going to go to their boss. So those types of circumstances. There's some evidence that younger women are sometimes more vulnerable just because they're maybe seen as an easy target. They aren't as, they don't have the experience. Maybe they don't understand what's appropriate professional workplace behavior. So, and also, of course, our LGBTQ plus community, both men and women, are very, very vulnerable to this type of behavior.
So, Eric, when you get that phone call, will you help me? What are the first questions you ask?
Well, that's very hard to answer. The way we handle it, we do intakes in our firm, and then we have people come in, and we meet with them for at least an hour to fully discuss what has gone on, what has happened. And often it's a very, very difficult conversation, particularly if I, as a man, a meeting with a woman who's been sexually harassed. I mean, we have some people who come in who want to meet with a female attorney, which is very understandable. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, and the way we do it, once we have the basic information, we then try to determine if these claims can be substantiated. Are there witnesses? And not necessarily just of the harassment, but are there other witnesses who've been harassed by the same supervisor in the same type of a situation? And once we can establish that, then we will often move forward.
Is it hard when you don't have that pattern, when it's essentially a he says, she says?
Sexual harassment cases, like all discrimination cases, from the plaintiff's standpoint, are very, very difficult to handle. You know, the figure in Utah, I think the UALD, which is the state agency which processes the charges, you have to go through an agency first. I think they only find, 3%, or it's in favor of plaintiffs in discrimination cases. And wow. That, I think, is a good idea of how difficult these cases really are. Fortunately, I think what we're beginning to see, just the beginning, is that there had always been a presumption, I think, that a woman who came in and made a complaint of sexual harassment had to be lying. It had to be made up. I think that's beginning to change, where they're being given the benefit of the doubt by employers more and more. Not all, and we only see a very small percentage of employers. I'm sure there's a lot of employers, the ones who Mike talked with, who handle it well. We only see a very small percentage who don't handle it well.
In your report, Robin, it says the National Center for the Prosecution of Violence Against Women reports that the incidence of someone falsely reporting a rape or sexual assault is very low, between 2 to 10%. Yet the cases are hard to prove, and we tend to disbelieve the victim often.
There was actually an interview through NPR that we looked at for our study that was fascinating. These were anecdotal stories told by specific judges, but in some instances, there'd be a number of very egregious sexual harassment things that happened within a short period of time. And the judge would say, well, it happened just over a week. That doesn't show that it's pervasive. And then in other circumstances, there would be a long spread, you know, years and years of this pattern of behavior. And they said, well, it happened over such, you know, it didn't happen very often, so it doesn't show that it's
severe. And those are two of the things that you need to show. It's severe and pervasive. And so there's this catch-22 situation with, you know, some of these circumstances. They are very hard to demonstrate, very hard to prove.
And Marina, you talked about how this is messy. That, you know, we should first and foremost believe the person who's coming forward, but the proof process might be messy.
Right, and it is, and I think that that's our human experience, and I especially given that this movement is sort of pushing against the patriarchy, and I think the patriarchy is nervous about that. And I think especially as we look at cases like Kevin Spacey, where some of these really high profile cases go back years and years. And I think it makes a lot of people feel really nervous that at some point in time, they may have made a mistake, or they worry that they may have made a mistake. And I think that it really does go back to our misunderstandings about consent, which have become really, and I'm kind of taking this is a little bit of a divergence, but to circle back about teaching consent, I'm interested ever since I've had a kiddo that we don't teach it sooner, and I wondered how it could be so unclear. And then I had a kid, and people demand to touch him, and that he kiss them, and that he do all these other things. And so it's been an interesting process of having nieces and nephews and having a son. And when people say to Harvey, all right, come here, and he doesn't want to, and I say, Harvey, do you want to go see them? And when he doesn't want to, I say, okay, that's your choice. And I'm kind of telling them and him at the same time that we have to teach people how to treat us. In addition to how do we handle situations when we're unfamiliar or asking, can I touch you? We have to also teach people how to respond to that so that women don't necessarily have to keep this bottled up, or men, but that the clarity happens earlier and sooner and faster. And I think that that might help in the long run, trying to figure out how do we handle all these cases. People handling them more in the moment, hopefully, if possible.
Kendra, do you want to add to that?
Well, I think that, as a victim service provider, our philosophy and something that we talk with about in the community is to start by believing. And how we initially react to somebody who discloses is so critical. It really can impact whether or not they reach out for help and support and services. I think as community members, as neighbors, as parishioners, as coworkers, employers, we don't have to solve all of the problems when somebody discloses or try to be sure that we ask all the right questions. What we can do is say, I believe you, and I'm sorry that that happened to you, and let me get you connected to a resource that can support you and help you.
Liza wants to add something.
I just want to say, I think in conversations that I've had with Renee about this, one of the things is I would take it even a step further. I completely agree with you. But I'm hopeful that one of the outcomes of the Me Too movement is that we will not just be supportive when someone discloses, but we will defend those who feel like they can't stand up for themselves. I mean, those of you both here and in the listening audience who know me know I don't take much crap. And so I have been lucky in my life in not, in my experiences with sexual harassment, to have not been threatened, have not been one of the powerless. But that's just luck. That's not anything special I did. And I'm hopeful that the Me Too movement will empower people to not only, as you said, be believing and supportive when people come forward with stories, but also to step forward and say, cut that crap out.
Eric?
And in the employment situation, we have an interesting case right now where the court has ruled that the employer is not responsible for the sexual assault that occurred, but the court is holding them responsible for how they responded to the sexual assault. For example, the individual who did the assault, he was under investigation, and according to their policies, they allowed him to go on to paid leave for some 6 months. In comparison, our client, the person who was assaulted, was required to immediately come back to work And they refused to provide any sort of protection, any kind of alert system where, if this person showed up at work. So I think that's sort of the follow-up on this. It's not there. The employer is not, they didn't cause the assault. They didn't allow it to occur. It's the reaction after the fact, this very demeaning attitude towards the woman. Like, we don't believe you. This is your problem,
So, Mike, let's say a small business out there is listening to this. They don't really have a policy in place. They don't have a lot of money to spend on a big-time attorney like you and Eric. What should they do?
Well, both Eric and I are worth every penny, by the way, even though I probably couldn't afford myself if I needed a lawyer. So I tell businesses to think of this in the same way they think of their health. Right. So we want, with our health, we want to take preventive steps, checkups, et cetera. So in the employment context, we want to do that too. We want to have policies that clearly articulate an appropriate company culture. We want to do training, make sure people understand what the policies require. And we want to, make sure that culture is maintained. But we also, in our health, if something arises and we need to go see a doctor, we get treatment. So we need to get treatment, too, from time to time, because issues do arise in the workplace, and an employer has to respond to them appropriately to investigate, to reach a fair and honest conclusion about what happened, and if they find there's a problem, they have to remedy it. So employers have to both walk the walk and talk the talk. And that's true for small employers as well as large employers, and that's typically what I suggest they do.
Yes, Eric.
One thing I want to point out, there is a problem we have in Utah regarding small employers. Most of these sexual harassment, sexual assault cases go forward under Title VII. The original Title VII, it still has a 15-employee baseline, and Utah's law also has a 15-employee baseline. Many states, I don't know how many now, 30-something, have lowered that number for claims under state law. Our legislature has refused to do it. So one of the problems we see is that these smaller employers are not liable or not being found liable for sexual harassment or sexual assault.
And Robin, your family has a business and you're going through these conversations right now.
We do. We have a small business. And I think I want to absolutely second everything you were saying, that this is preventative care. Everybody should invest in this. But really, for those small businesses who feel like, I don't have $100 to spend on this, there are resources. There are, I went to the internet when we were doing this thing, and you can look at the Society for Human Resource Management, SHRM, on their website. They have hundreds of articles that you can go and read. Here are some ways to talk to your employees. Here are some ways to set up some things. So it's not a substitute at all for appropriate legal advice and setting up things in a super legit way. But nobody has an excuse to say, we couldn't afford to learn how to teach our employees to create a safe environment.
Are we seeing new laws saying that companies of a certain size need to put sexual harassment policies in place and training in place?
Well, my firm has been pushing the legislature for a number of years to try to amend the state law to get the number, the threshold much lower. We've not been successful. Other states, they have been. I think Idaho now, it's if you have one employer or more, you're potentially liable for a sexual harassment case under Idaho law.
Yes, Mike.
And we have a number of clients who are in the smaller employer category, and Eric's right, they're, if they don't have 15 or more employees, they're not subject to the federal or state anti-discrimination laws. But we actually tell them to do the same thing that larger employers are doing. Because, a clever plaintiff's lawyer like Eric can find a way to sue a smaller employer, even though it's more difficult. But it's also just the right thing to do. I mean, it's silly to suggest that because your, employers aren't covered by a certain law that they should be treated in a less humane way or a less appropriate way. I think it's bad business. And so we've had that talk with a number of small businesses too, that look, even though you're not subject to this law, you really should have policies and do preventive work and training and react as if you are subject to them.
Yes, Robin.
And can you help me know if I'm right on this? Even when you think there's only one employee, well, how can there be sexual harassment if there's only one person? But sexual harassment doesn't need to happen between two employees of a company. It can occur when it can come from a vendor. It can come from a customer. Is that correct? Am I understanding that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we see that quite often where someone will come into the office and start making inappropriate comments and advances towards usually a woman who's behind the, you know, the front desk or whatever. And the employer in that case has an obligation to act to prevent that from reoccurring.
Got a tough question for you. And Jacob, I'm going to put you on the spot. Is Me Too, have we seen it become weaponized? Have we seen it as a weapon against maybe an employer you don't like or someone else you don't like?
So I don't think so. And here's why I don't think so. We talked already about the statistics on sexual assault, sexual harassment, and reporting, and how often they're actually fabricated. And it's a tiny, tiny amount, right? 3%. Some people say as high as 10%, but it's a small amount. And I think, if anything, it still is not being used to the extent that I think it needs to be. The Harvey Weinsteins of the world, he was doing horrible things, but for every Harvey Weinstein, there's got to be thousands who aren't subject to social media scrutiny, right? Who can't be forced out of their position based on societal backlash, so to speak. And so I also think that most victims, knowing, I don't have personal experience in terms of me individually, but knowing folks who have been harassed or sexually assaulted, I don't know why somebody would intentionally go through that publicly. And so while it can happen, I saw a story today about, I think it was a former, I want to say football player, where his girlfriend or someone had made it up. Mm-hmm. And that gets national headlines. But to me, that's newspapers trying to sell advertisements and clicks more than it is about the reality of the scenario, which is that for every one of those, there's all these others where it's not happening. So I think a lot of the idea about it being weaponized, to me and from the perspective of my students, I think comes from people pushing back against victims wanting rights. And I think anytime you see those who are oppressed pushing into an area of power, you're going to see a backlash. And I think in this case, the idea of weaponization is the response of that backlash.
I'm going to put you all on the spot. Senator Al Franken, the picture where he's reaching out to the woman who's asleep, the woman he was on a USO tour with, should he have resigned? You want it, Jacob?
Yeah, I comment first. I think yes. And I think, and people probably disagree with me. I think that in the initial stages, we go through this kind of back and forth of where's the line, right? And I was reading this morning about the fact that it's kind of on a spectrum, right? Like sexual assault and harassment, every instance of it is not the same. The response is not the same. The victims are different. The perpetrator is different. And so the response and the punishment is going to be different. We have that with our laws. I think Senator Franken, given his position in society, I think he had a responsibility, right? And again, people may say, well, it's not that big of a deal. But as a teacher who teaches kids, that image is a big deal. Because when I have sophomores who this comes up in class, right? And these conversations happen, not just in my social justice class, but in my English 11 class. As a teacher, I'm not going to defend that because I don't think it's right. And so to my kids, I would want them to know that it's wrong. And I think that's a way that Al Franken can send a message that I messed up and this is me. I can't fix the way that person's been affected. I can't change their trauma, but at least I can state that I screwed up and take some responsibility.
Liza, you wanted to add something and then Mike has something.
Yeah, just because I have to say I agree with you. As deeply disheartened as I was to lose Senator Franken as one of the lone voices of sanity in D.C., but I agree. You know, as a leader, you have to set an example. I do hope that what starts to happen with the Me Too movement or this entire cultural conversation is at some point that we have a bit of a conversation about proportionality, you know, and a bit of a conversation about, you know, the person I mentioned who inappropriately puts his hand on the shoulders of women, I don't feel assaulted, and I would never want to lessen the experience of people who have actually been assaulted by portraying it as that. But I do think that's a piece of the conversation that we have yet to have.
Mike, do you want to add something about Franken? Or
Actually, about both points, just briefly. I think there's probably some other politicians who should follow Al Franken's example. And then on the notion of proportionality, I think that's a very good point. We're constantly dealing with that when we're advising clients. They'll say, well, we found that this employee, this supervisor, did X. Do we have to fire him or her for that? Because sometimes claims are made against women, too. And so we have a discussion about that very issue. You know, what's the, how severe is it? Has it happened before? What was the impact? You know, what sort of remorse are you seeing from the individual involved? And so I think employers in particular have to have a discussion about proportionality when they decide the consequences for misbehavior in the workplace.
Marina, your thoughts on that?
Oh, you know, I think so too. I think whenever the conversation about proportionality comes up, I think of Garrison Keillor. And I think that it was his instance that really sort of in my mind jogged me from, I don't actually care if it's being weaponized. We are trying to find equilibrium. And if we accidentally go the wrong way, or go, I shouldn't say the wrong way, if we go the right way too far, then that is just part of us finding our way to balance. And then Garrison Keillor, and I didn't know how to feel, and I really, really started thinking about it a lot, and I started noticing a lot of the men and women in my life, especially women in the LGBT community who are having more interactions with other women or men with men, wondering and questioning and then that idea of not knowing if they were ever doing something and that even with the best of intentions that they would be doing something wrong. And so the idea of weaponizing almost makes me, I don't like it. It makes me kind of mad because I think that it's an over-dramatization of us finding equilibrium. But at the same time, I do think that to talk about it semantically as proportionality and looking at different instances, with different severity is a really important nuance as we try to figure our way through this.
So Robin, how do we get, in terms of proportionality, how do we get men maybe calling out other men on inappropriate behavior or women calling out other women? How do we get each other's backs on this and say that's not okay, whereas before maybe we would have shrugged it off?
That's a great question. And it brings to something that was brought up earlier, which is the bystander effect, right? Which is really, really critical in dealing with this issue in our workplaces. So I think education and talking about this openly is the first place to start in every single workplace. One of the things that we found in our report when it comes to sexual harassment is that when women were asked if they'd ever experienced sexual harassment, 25% of the women said yes. But once they were given a specific definition of sexual harassment and they were given specific examples, that number went up to 40%. Wow. And so when we talk about this openly and with men and women, with all our employees, with our families, with our students, to say, this type of behavior is not okay. And we give clear, instructions and things like that, that it's really going to help make it clear for people. And then the hardest thing is to be brave enough to be a bystander and to speak up for someone else. And I love what you said about defending those people. A lot of research has found that in situations where inappropriate things are going on, someone makes a comment and there are a few other people around, it is very hard for the person who's experienced it to stand up in that moment. But if someone else, especially a man, calling out another man saying, hey, that wasn't cool, that's not okay that you're saying that, it has a great potential to defuse the situation and to avoid the escalation. Because what happens in workplaces, well, and everywhere, is when a little thing happens, oh, I got away with that. Nobody thought it was a big deal. She was okay that I made that comment. Well, maybe I'll go a little further. And so things can really escalate. And so when people are willing and brave enough to stand up and be a bystander speaking out against something inappropriate, something not okay, then that has great power to make change.
Yes, Liza.
And I just wanted to add to that because it is brave to be a bystander. And given that we are almost always going to have men and women in the workplace working together, there are those occasions where what's going on is flirting and what's going on is consensual and what's going on is not harassment. I just don't think there's any way to legislate or train that out of the system, whether it's men, women, women, men, LGBT, it doesn't matter. But I think that we have to make sure when we're empowering people to be bystanders that we're also empowering them to not shut that bystander mode down when they get slapped down by a couple of coworkers who were like, yeah, no, you just chilled on my thing and back off. That was fine with me. And I'm like, okay, that was fine with you. It's not okay with me. Why don't you guys go get a hotel room or whatever? But it's just a reality of life. We spend an awful lot of our time in the workplace. We spend an awful lot of our time with our coworkers. And, you know, some of us have married them, not me. Hi, Chris. But, you know, it just happens. And I think as we're empowering people to be bystanders, we have to step up from being bystanders. We have to make sure that they also recognize that it's okay to call it out and be maybe not wrong, but maybe be rebuffed.
Yes, Eric.
I think employers also have to create an atmosphere where women can say, no, that's unacceptable. No, I don't like that. And unfortunately, what we see too often is when there's this huge imbalance of power. You know, if you're a lower level employee and a vice president starts hitting on you, it's very, very difficult to say no. But that's really, I mean, if we could empower women in the workplace to feel comfortable doing that, I think a lot of these things would stop immediately. And along with that, I mean, we see a lot of cases with what it's called retaliation, where women have said, no, stop that, and then they're retaliated against. They get less favorable assignments, they get less favorable hours to work, and on, you know, that type of thing. That is, in my mind, really horrible, detrimental conduct on the part of the employer.
Kendra, at the Peace House, you guys see what the emotional response is of a victim of sexual violence and sexual harassment. And it probably is much deeper than people realize when they say, oh, I'm sorry that happened to you, but it doesn't seem too bad. You know, get over it. It's going to be fine. I mean, that has to carry a huge emotional weight to a victim.
Yeah, every victim of sexual assault or harassment or abuse, it's their own individual experience. And there's a lot of different ways that they may respond to that. And experiencing abuse and trauma can have lifelong impacts on people and often does. And so it's so important for us to create a space of safety and support where people are able to get the care and services that they need to heal and recover. We see many survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence managing, you know, anxiety and depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, feeling very isolated, oftentimes feeling a sense of shame and guilt, and not feeling, you know, connected and supported. And so it's so critical for us to create that space, that opportunity for individuals to know they're not alone, that there are services available to help them work through that healing and recovery process, and that we can do that on an individualized basis, that as an agency, Peace House works to meet people where they're at. So they get to help us understand what their needs are, and then we support them with those needs.
And can someone come forward like Liza's relative and said, this happened to me 30 years ago. I've been dealing with this. You guys provide services for that person as well?
Absolutely. We work with individuals who have been impacted by sexual abuse and child abuse, and they're now adults. We work with sexual assault survivors and domestic violence survivors. No matter the duration or last incident that they had, we have a 24-hour helpline that's available. So if somebody wants to just reach out and talk to somebody confidentially about services that are available and about their specific situation and their safety and their wellness, they're able to call our 24-hour hotline at 1-800-647-9161. And then we have a number of other services that we're able to provide support to survivors with, whether that be, safe housing, counseling for adults and children, case management services, as well as legal advocacy.